Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. It is 2021, and here is the first episode of the new year and of this new decade, depending on how you count the decades. I am proud and pleased to bring you episode 274. This is the January 2021 preview of Retinal Physician. Joined by Drs. Brian Doe and Basil Williams for this episode. And we preview several topics from this edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician can be found online for free at retinalphysician.com. You can also subscribe to receive it in print. And we discuss several topics. First, we talk about interface vitrectomy and Dr. Steve Charles' idea of doing interface vitrectomy in the setting of an air meniscus or a perfluorocarbon liquid meniscus or oil. We then move on to discuss the value of culture results for endophthalmitis and how we should be obtaining cultures and should we be obtaining cultures for those cases, and end with the discussion of malpractice in retina. As always, a list of financial disclosures that are relevant can be found in the episode description. You can also subscribe to our podcast on the website, retinapodcast.com. And if you look in the episode description, there's a little link to go to the Academy website that will let you sign up for CME credits. And if you have any issues claiming those credits, please let us know. We can have the Academy staff help you through it. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now happy to be joined by two retina specialists for this preview of the January 2021 edition of Retinal Physician. First, in his first appearance in the podcast kicking off the new year, is Dr. Brian Doe from Washington, D.C. area. Brian, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Jay. It's an honor to be here with you both.
Next, and not last but not least, Dr. Basil Williams from Cincinnati, Ohio, and Cincinnati Eye Institute, University of Cincinnati. Basil, welcome.
Thanks so much, Jay. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Brian does not understand the show when he says it's an honor to be with us, but he will understand this show soon enough, whether he wants to or not. So we're going to preview the January 2021 edition of Retinal Physician. As always, these articles are available online at retinalphysician.com. Our goal is not to summarize or go in depth the articles like we do in our journal club. These are kind of review type articles, but to use them as jumping off points for discussion. So the first article we're going to talk about is by none other but the famous Dr. Steve Charles, famous for his work with vitrectomy. And Dr. Charles wrote this article, Interface Vitrectomy for Proliferative Vitreoretinopathy, subtitle, A Variety of Procedures Can Be Performed. And he talks about this idea of interface vitrectomy, which is the idea that doing vitrectomy essentially not in a fluid-filled eye, either when there's oil or air or PFO, doing things ranging from removing the vitreous to peeling to doing drainage of fluid, doing a retinectomy. And Dr. Charles has spoken about this before. He talks about the understanding of where the fluid layer would be in those situations. And then he talks about the idea of how the fluid air exchange was developed. And he was actually one of the people who really developed the fluid air exchange and promoted it. And so the idea of doing vitrectomy under air, he talks about how that's actually a pretty visible interface in his hands, and that's why he calls it interface vitrectomy. And then the idea of what about if there's oil already in? Well, he talks about maybe you don't need to remove the oil at all. If you're going to go into a reoperation with oil in, you can do your peeling under oil, you can skip steps, and you know there's kind of this extra, people call it a second hand, almost helping you with the oil, holding things in place as you peel. So, Basil, I'll let you lead this off. Let's start with the idea of operating under oil and work backwards. So, I had a couple of attendings at fellowship who did this, and I don't think it's unreasonable in these cases to at least try to start under oil, and then if you can't get everything done you need to get done, or you get up to a certain point and then switching over, I think that's reasonable. You know, I've very rarely come across a case, and I'm not as talented or prolific as Dr. Charles, where I've been able to do the whole case under oil. What's been kind of your experience working under oil?
Yeah, so I would agree with you, Jay. I think that the idea is great. I like the thought process of trying to keep the oil in place. I think it depends a little bit on what your goals of the surgery are with the oil in the first place. So if there's a lot of PVR, if there's a battery detachment and the oil obviously needs to stay in or to be exchanged, then it makes sense to keep the oil in. depends a little bit on if things are okay and you're trying to peel some membranes and ultimately take the oil out, then obviously that might not be necessary. But I would agree with you that I have had some difficulty doing the entire case remaining under oil as well. And maybe it's something that requires a little bit more time to get comfortable with. But I have therefore reversed to more traditional methods of removing the oil and then working under fluid.
Yeah, and I think a key thing if you're going to try this is if you put your infusion is to keep it clamped, obviously, the whole time, because sometimes it's going to titrate up to a pressure of 25 or 30 or 35, whatever you have it set at on your machine, and then you end up filling some fluid. I think one of the difficulties, Basil, I found, and I'm curious, Brian, to get your experience, is like, let's say you go to peel and it's filled with oil. Well, the oil is going to float on top of any liquid that's there, and hopefully you have a full oil fill, but generally you can never get a perfect oil fill, and I feel there's always a fluid oil meniscus kind of at the retinal surface, and that can create a little bit of optical difficulty when you're trying to go down. You're hitting that meniscus as you're trying to peel, and that's sometimes some of the difficulty with working under air we'll get to. But Brian, your experience working under oil and any kind of things you've used it for?
So like both of you, my experience working under oil for the entire case is pretty limited. I will say that I probably haven't done a case like that since I was in fellowship. I recall a couple of cases in which, you know, there were these sort of unusual PVR bands sort of spanning the vitreous cavity, you know, in which case, you know, segmentation of the band sort of relieved the traction and, you know, there wasn't necessarily a whole lot else to do. I've always found that, you know, working with forceps, when there's silicone oil around, sort of creates an extra lubricating effect and, you know, can make it a little bit difficult to grab your target tissues. Steve Charles here talks about, you know, working at sort of the fluid oil interface. And like you suggested, Jay, I think, you know, optically it can be a little bit difficult to sort of determine when you're, you know, in the right sort of fluid phase and peeling what you actually want to peel. Theoretically, I like the idea of working under oil, and you know, maybe it's something that I'll try to do next time I've got somebody who's under oil for whatever reason and developing PVR and redetaching. But certainly in practice, my tendency has been to go more traditional routes like you, Basil, and sort of take the oil out and work on membranes and address you know, retinal redetachment as one normally would.
Right. Well, and I think we all kind of hit on, there are some advantages to working under oil. I think one of the advantages of a redetachment under oil is it can clearly show you the area that is the quote unquote problem area, the area that is under traction with the oil tamponade is generally a focus that's going to be an issue. A lot of times when you take the oil out, you may have a more widespread detachment, maybe more difficult to pinpoint, especially as an early surgeon. And I do, again, I do sometimes in some of these cases peel under oil. It's just the other steps, like you talked about, I generally kind of switch over to fluid and, you know, go the traditional route. The last thing I'll kind of mention about this before we talk about air is I do think that certain things would be difficult, such as aspirating fluid or things like that, just because you can't really engage the cutter in oil without clogging it a little bit. Now, you may aspirate some of the oil when you're doing that and then refill at the end, and I guess you could get away with that. But I do notice there's also sometimes a clogging effect with the oil under the cutter, kind of oil bubbles getting stuck on the mouth. So in the idea, Brian, we'll kind of sneak back and I'll ask you about this idea of working under air. So I've heard Dr. Charles talk about this since I was a fellow going to like the Mass Eye and Ear course in my first year. And he always made me feel a little bit bad because I was like, I never could quite, even at that stage, see as well under air certain things. But he talks about how you can really see the air vitreous interface. He's really shown videos and advocates the idea of doing the vitrectomy under air, doing a retinectomy under air, peeling under air. Again, I think it's all how we're trained. There's multiple ways to achieve the same sort of result. I again find that it's not necessarily as consistent a view. You do get, some cases you do get a better view under air. You get maybe a wider view in some pseudo fakes under air, but I feel like the view under air is much more variable, and also that meniscus issue becomes really annoying. For example, even in a regular case, if I want to diathermize something under air at the retinal surface, that there's a little learning curve to learning exactly where that is, because right as you're going down to that point is when the meniscus gives you that reflex and kind of glares back at you. So your experience working under air and kind of the things you feel comfortable or don't feel comfortable in that situation?
So, you know, as far as sort of crucial steps in dealing with retinal detachment, I tend not to do them under air. I know that you know, there are lots of people out there who have talked about doing peripheral vitrectomy under air and, you know, how good the visualization can be of the peripheral vitreous. Certainly, you know, when going to air, you know, one can note residual vitreous skirt, you know, sort of has this glistening, almost like jellyfish-like appearance. But I'm always concerned about sucking up vitreous and perhaps causing iatrogenic breaks that would be much more difficult to visualize, that would also then secondarily require you to go back to a fluid phase, you know, for another look. So I tend to always try to do my vitrectomy under fluid, as most of us are trained to do. So, you know, theoretically, I like the idea of, you know, maybe scanning PVR, you know, certain PVR membranes under air. One of my partners, Mohsen Ali, who trained at Duke, you know, he has some experience doing that, you know, when he was back in Durham. And, you know, having seen some videos, it seems like a nice way to sort of demarcate your membranes and things that you would like to peel. But, I haven't found that to be necessary. So, you know, my personal experience, again, working under air, doing anything besides endolaser is pretty limited.
You know, Basil, I would think that, again, Dr. Charles talked about doing a retinectomy under air, for example. I guess one of the advantages, people talk about this quote-unquote air test people used to talk about when we were in training, where you can go to air and then you kind of get a sense of, just like we were talking about under oil, you get a sense of the areas that attach and the areas that are still ish problem areas, and then maybe that helps guide your retinectomy. It's similar to, example, filling up PFO and flattening a retina with PVR and kind of seeing, okay, where is the problem area? And again, those, that can be one of the hardest steps when you start as a young surgeon, is, or as a fellow, is kind of figuring out, where is the problem area? Where are you going to focus your attention to reattach a retina? Well, going to air can not only highlight that area, but Dr. Charles talks about the idea you can cut that area with the retinectomy at the same time. I guess we're all kind of on the same page, so I don't make this a boring conversation, but I do think it's a decent idea. I wonder, again, one of the things I always worry about is the air is kind of working for you in the sense it's reattaching the retina, but working against you in the sense it's pushing the retina closest to the RPE. And one of my biggest concerns and fears when staffing or in operating is not striking the RPE with the cutter when doing a retinectomy. I almost would rather have a little bit of space there. Kind of your experience working under air, even if you haven't done it, you're thinking about it, kind of the pros and cons, what would you say?
Yeah, so unfortunately, I don't think I'm adding a lot of diversity to this conversation in terms of thought process. You know, I definitely would use air or go to air to help establish if all of my work is done, if all the traction has been released, if there are any problem areas that are additional. But if I see some problem areas, I will work on a little bit of residual vitreous under air at that time. But if it becomes more of an issue, it becomes more challenging, or I'm a little bit concerned about the air working against me in that scenario, I will go back to fluid and work a little more before I go back to air again. So I think a lot of this is a matter of getting comfortable with the visualization differences and getting used to working under air. So I think, you know, there's definitely some value to doing it. It just requires a level of comfort and practice. And I just I haven't done that much under air.
So let's change gears and let's talk about something a little more controversial, which is the value of vitreous and aqueous sampling for culture and endophthalmitis. And this was an article that was written with points by Dr. Harry Flynn, Dr. Sunir Garg, and those are two of the people who trained me. So I'll take whatever side you guys don't take to make this more interesting. But really the fundamental question is, if you have a patient with endophthalmitis, do you do cultures? And because the real question for any test we do in medicine is, what are you doing differently with that result, right? And so there was a recent paper published from Wills with Vander as the senior author talking about this and talking about the idea that, you know, treatment decisions did not really change based on culture results. So Basil, you are a loyal Dr. Harry Flynn disciple trained at the Bascom Palmer School. Why should we get cultures on these patients? So, do you think that it's worth doing a vitreous tap in every setting? Are there settings where you would say an aqueous tap alone is okay? Are there settings where you think it's okay to just treat empirically and not tap? What's kind of your gestalt on this idea?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. And as you said, I am a loyal student of Dr. Flynn, so don't try and get me in any trouble here. I'm an advocate for a vitreous tap when doing these cases. And there's a lot of reasons. First of all, in the acute onset postoperative scenario, where it's presumably a bacterial infection, you're going to be giving both sets of antibiotics, so vancomycin and ceftazidime, or something that'll cover gram positives and gram negatives. And so you're giving 0.2 of fluid at that time. And then I often will also be giving dexamethasone. So if you're giving 0.3 of fluid at that time, you definitely need to take something out of the eye. And that was a point made by Dr. Garg. If you're already going to be taking material out of the eye, it seems to make sense to send that material off to be assessed. Next, I think, is a more grand view of things, is that there are differences in trends of microbes and susceptibilities that may happen over time. And so I think there's some value into getting cultures to see if there's a change in the types of bugs that are happening with endophthalmitis, and if there's a change in the response to antibiotics overall, because we won't know that unless we're capturing data. And there's obviously some regional differences in terms of what bugs are most common. For instance, in the southeast United States and in the Florida area, fungal infections like Fusarium, Aspergillus tend to be more common, versus in the Northeast, it tends to be more of a cancer. So I think having ideas about those shifts is valuable as well. And then there may be a rare case where your management is changed based on the culture, but you're not going to know which case that is beforehand. So I think there's a lot of value in doing it routinely. Now, for me, the cases where I'll do an ACTAP are often ones where I think the infection is arising from anterior. So the rare case, or if you have a tube infection or a TRAB infection, you can see the infection is primarily anterior, and you think you can get a good sample from the anterior chamber, I think it's reasonable to do that. Or if you have a corneal ulcer-related endophthalmitis, which is quite rare, but if you do end up with one of those cases and you can culture the cornea, you'll likely be able to get away with that without requiring to do a vitreous tap or a patient with endogenous endophthalmitis with a known systemic cause. But other than that, I'm pretty much getting a vitreous sample and sending it off.
Yeah, and Dr. Garg, to his credit, he referenced those Will studies, but he also mentioned that, you know, there is value to culture, as you talked about prognosis, and Dr. Flynn talks about the malpractice issue and the side of medical legally having some protection. And so if you have to remove volume anyway to get the antibiotics in, you might as well send it for culture instead of discarding it. No, Brian, what are your thoughts and philosophies? I would say the one argument I've heard from retinal specialists in this community is, from a practical perspective, sometimes it's just difficult to find a lab that can actually process these specimens. I think, Basil, we were spoiled at Bascom Palmer. Brian, training at USC for your fellowship, maybe you had good access to a lab that would culture this. I think there are retina specialists in this country who just don't have good access where they're located to culture. Doesn't mean you shouldn't take that fluid and sample, but Brian, I guess if you are going to culture, do you think the vitreous versus aqueous matters? Because people argue sometimes about the downsides of a vitreous tap, such as risk of tear, versus an aqueous tap, which has minimal risk if performed safely.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think, just from the articles that, this particular piece referred to, in terms of, the yield of vitreous tap versus aqueous tap, I think it's pretty clear that, you're more likely to have a positive culture result if you're taking something from the vitreous. But, we've all been in situations where, either it's a young patient with, not particularly liquefied vitreous, or, they might have lots of fiber membranes in the vitreous cavity. And, no matter how hard you try, you still have a tough time getting a sample. Like Basil, I would say that when I have a high suspicion that the infection has originated from some type of anterior segment origin, whether it's previous glaucoma surgery or a leaking cataract wound or something like that, I'll tend to take a sample from the anterior chamber. Whereas if it's something like a post-injection endophthalmitis, then I'm more likely to try to get a vitreous sample. I think we're all speaking with a little bit of bias because, we all presumably have access to reasonable microbiologic analysis of these samples. And, maybe we'd be singing a different tune if, we were out in, rural Idaho, where, maybe the nearest hospital with reasonable, micro support is a couple of hours away. But, even though I'm in private practice, we have a number of, tertiary care centers nearby where, patients can take the specimen and, and we can have culture results fairly easily without too much headache. So, I hate to be in total agreement with you guys, but I think my practice patterns are fairly similar.
Yeah, Brian, my only thing is we have a very loyal listening base in rural Idaho, and I don't know what the microbiology situation is there, but they may reach out in anger if that was inaccurate, but I don't know. So they can reach out and let me know. Let's kind of switch gears to our last article, which is called Malpractice in Retina. Again, Dr. Flynn, Dr. Smitty, Prashant Iyer, one of our excellent fellows, and Zhang Yan, Dr. Smitty's research fellow, put this together. And this is a fascinating article. We just released an episode a couple of weeks back about malpractice during residency, but this is about malpractice out as a retina specialist, right? So again, this is a good article. If you haven't read about malpractice, you need a refresher. They kind of go through what malpractice hinges on, right? Negligence, this physician-patient relationship, something that's below the standard of care, and whether that has actually resulted in harm, right? It has to result in harm. So it's interesting. They all go through these common reasons that patients will sue, how often these claims are claimed. That the most often legal outcomes were involving, retina, like retained lens fragments and how those costs. And then the idea of what does this mean in terms of protection? What does it mean during the pandemic? I mean, these are all questions we don't really have answers for. Hopefully malpractice is not something that people were worrying about during the peak of the pandemic in their region. Brian, again, we'll snake back, and I read this article and I felt it was a good refresher. And when you read about this, if for someone who's not hasn't read this, what's kind of the most striking thing to you that you learned? Like what is does it surprise you that, for example, the most common cause of litigation in one study was retinal detachment? I really think that it would be difficult in many cases in retina to prove that there was harm done, just because a lot of our retinal pathologies cause damage that isn't fixable sometimes. But it's interesting that the biggest failure that's been caused is, $275,000 for retina specialists who don't diagnose or fail to diagnose a retinal detachment. I mean, what kind of lessons do you take from this if you were teaching, younger attendings and fellows about malpractice?
So, I think one of the more striking things about this article was the kinds of, payments that were made on behalf of pediatric patients. And, we always talk about the kind of liability that our colleagues who, treat patients with pediatric retinal disorders, ROP in particular, the kinds of, liability that they assume. And to see the numbers is somewhat staggering. There was a lot in here that wasn't terribly surprising to me. You always hear about, the kinds of relationships that you try to foster and engender with your patients to try to avoid, lawsuits to begin with. And, just considering the fact that, the volume of surgery that we do for retinal detachment in particular, it's not surprising that the percent of cases, that go to court are as high as they are for retinal detachment in particular. It's interesting to me that cases of endophthalmitis from partial lane of vitrectomy seemed to pay out quite a bit more than endophthalmitis resulting from cataract surgery. I don't know what the reasoning for that is. Obviously, it's a little bit more uncommon, and it's something that we don't see that frequently, but I would be interested to see what, the reasoning behind that was.
Yeah, I would say that, we'd have to look at that original paper from 2018, but I would guess one of two things. One, it's so rare that maybe it's one or two cases that are driving that trend. And then the second is the causative organisms may be different and maybe more virulent, even though it's rare. Maybe the outcomes are worse. I don't know. Just because there are so many endophthalmitis cases from cataract surgery that, for example, coagulase negative staph that can still have really, really good visual outcomes, and maybe then there's no case for malpractice. Basil, any comments on anything Brian said or on this article, general kind of thoughts on managing malpractice as a retina specialist?
So I think Brian hit on a couple of the large points, and I think in the very beginning, the very opening paragraph, they were talking about how there's the average ophthalmologist has a 90% chance of getting a claim made against them in a 10-year time span. So it's something that a lot of people, the vast majority of us, are going to deal with it at some point or at various points in our career. And it highlights the need, the requirement to develop good patient relationships, to always keep the patients that have had a tough time, whether it be through complications or just a poor outcome, keep them close to you, maintain good relationships with them, keep them coming back to the office, see them more frequently. The article really highlights the point of making good eye contact and don't multitask when you're in those situations. So you actually let the patient know that you care about what's going on with them. And I think those things are all extremely important when you're in this kind of situation. And I think the other thing that I always think about in this scenario is the importance of documentation, appropriate documentation when you have these cases, and the challenges that EMR can sometimes bring, where a lot of times things are carried forward on the exam and in the discussion or in the plan, making sure that those are meticulously worked through to make sure that everything that is there is exactly what you want it to say. And because if it's not documented, then it didn't happen. Or if it was misdocumented, then that potentially can look bad for you down the road. So that's just something that's reinforced in this article that I try and keep in the front of my mind for these kind of cases.
Right. And then you can't fall prey to, as you were kind of referencing, to copy forward errors, right? Especially if you know it's a complicated post-op situation, you know something's atypical, like I know people are in a rush in clinic, or you're spending more time counseling the patient or maybe signing them up for a surgery or emergency procedure, making sure you update your exam and make sure you update your notes so things aren't being copied forward by a scribe or by a trainee or even by you yourself and resulting in a note that looks like it's contradictory, because contradictory notes legally don't look good. So guys, thank you so much. Brian, how was your first time? It was enjoyable?
So far so good. I'm looking forward to the next one.
There was only no one possible answer to that question, by the way, in this context on air. So, I'm glad that, that went smoothly. Guys, this is the first episode of 2021. We did kind of a recap episode of 2020. I don't think we have a reason to look backwards. But Brian and Basil, one thing in the field of retina that you're looking forward to in 2021? I'll go first. I was going to say, cheap cop-out, I am looking forward to the first in-person safe retina meeting where people feel comfortable and we're able to see each other in person, if that does happen in 2021. Hopefully it does towards the end of the year.
Yeah, I definitely shouldn't let you go first, because that's what I was going to say.
I was worried what you were going to say, so I had to seize it on it. I mean, you can kind of echo that statement. I mean, I think that people have done a really creative and great job with virtual meetings. Congratulate, I've been involved in that, and people have definitely done our best. I will be the first to say and call a spade, it is not the same thing. And when we can go back to some sort of in-person option, especially for certain meetings and certain groups and certain reunions, I think it will be a lot nicer.
For sure, absolutely.
Brian, I took the easy one, and then Basil just, you know, agreed with me. So I don't know if you have anything else.
This is a tough question. I haven't really thought about 2021 a whole lot, to be honest with you.
It's been tough to look ahead. I think that's been one of the big points about this year, right? Maybe that is the point. It'd be nice to get to a point where we can actually look ahead and look forward to things, rather than living in the moment is nice, but maybe it'd be nice to be able to plan things and do things and have something better on your social calendar than recording podcasts with Basil Williams and Jay Schreeder.
Well, listen, I'd be much happier if we were recording this podcast in a hotel room in Las Vegas, but
there are so many different ways I can take that. I just had a vision of like The Hangover or something. Okay. Well, Basil and Brian, be safe, be well. We're recording this before the holidays, so have a wonderful holiday season, and looking forward to 2021 with seeing both of you hopefully at some point.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jay. Thanks so much.
Many thanks to Drs. Doe and Williams for joining me for this episode. Remember, you can find this episode and all prior episodes on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's RETINAPodcast.com. That's 274 episodes spanning 4+ years, sorted by category, searchable, and really, really great content up there, thanks to all the great guests we've had over the years. Remember, you can find us also in your Apple Podcast or Android Podcast app. That's how I like to subscribe, is on my smartphone. And you can find us on Facebook and on Twitter at Retina Podcast. If you prefer to get updates in your email inbox, you can subscribe on the website to our mailing list and reach out to us. We love feedback. You can leave feedback on the Apple Podcast Store review page. We love to get feedback on good episodes, what you prefer to see better, what you prefer to see different, by emailing us anytime at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to our production team and social media team. That includes Drs. Louis Kai, Drs. Angela Chang, and Mike Minicasa. Thanks to listeners, what you do on a daily basis, what you will bring to the table every day in 2021, the articles you read and publish, and the conversations you inspire here. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.